Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. Great to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Guy. It's great to be here and a pleasure. So thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on. I do what I do with most people, you know, the power of the internet. A stranger reaches out to you across the electronic airwaves, but I've seen what you're doing, what you're about, and it's incredibly appealing. So just before we get into that, for those people that don't know you, just introduce yourself and give us a sense of who you are.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I am Rich Devinney, and I grew up in Connecticut, in the States, in New England, I guess, Connecticut area. Always wanted to be a Navy pilot. I wanted to fly jets with my twin brother. But in the late 90s, as I was finishing high school and getting into college, I discovered the Navy SEALs. This was before anybody knew what Navy SEALs were. And I started reading the books and ended up at university, at Purdue University, in an ROTC program, Navy ROTC program, and got commissioned into the Navy coming out of college and got selected to go to Navy SEAL training. And so I went and fortunately made it through. The odds aren't good with that type of training, but I did make it through.
So this is BUDS, right?
This is BUDS, so basic underwater demolition / SEAL training. And it's about a 90% attrition rate, so only about 10% get through. And but I did get through, and I graduated BUDS in 90. I got there in 96, so I graduated and started a career as a Navy SEAL. And of course, it would, you know, most of us would say, well, it was just a normal 20 plus year career, except we had, you know, 5 years later, 9/11, and we had a very kinetic time frame with wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I went there quite a bit and had a very, very interesting kinetic career. During which I had the opportunity to run a certain element of SEAL training for one of our specialized SEAL commands. So it wasn't the basic, it wasn't BUDS, it was a specialized command. And while there, really had to deconstruct what we were doing and had to articulate it in a way that made sense to us. And that's when I kind of discovered this idea of breaking performance down into these two factors. And these factors are really these attributes versus skills. And I did it for training. And I kind of kept in my mind, and as I retired, which was at the end of 2016, I retired from the Navy and began speaking to businesses and organizations about teams and high-performing teams, and kept on getting kind of a common question. Hey, we're building these dream teams, we're doing all this stuff, but a lot of times the teams are turning toxic, especially during times of uncertainty, challenge, and stress. And I was able to kind of remember and say, well, it seems to me you're making the same mistakes that I was thinking of when I was running this training. It's this idea between attributes and skills, and ended up saying to myself, well, no one's talking about this. Someone should write a book on it. And so I did. So I wrote a book, which got released this year in January, called The Attributes, the 25 Hidden Drivers of Optimal Performance, and have really now been speaking about this this book and this idea and coaching and counseling and doing talks about it. So here we are today.
And listen, I would love to just dive into that, because I've done a lot of work. I've focused in the leadership space. I've done a lot of work with people in the executive space. And then I've been lucky to work with some emergency services and that kind of space. And that's a real difference when you get people at the, for want of a better word, the pointy end of the spear, mm-hmm. doing things in an accelerated manner where the learning rate is very, very quick. Mm-hmm. And the tolerance for, well, we'll change it and figure it out in due course is a lot less, because actually, you know, we might be doing this again tomorrow. So, yeah, or right. Even if you're in the fire brigade or something like that, even in about an hour and a half from now,
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
So we've got to learn at pace and blah, 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 blah. So I really came to understand and see a lot of how people manage their egos, how they handle all these kind of things. So I'm fascinated. And you know, if you want to start somewhere else, please do. But I'd be really interested to hear what it is that you started to see, because I can't imagine everybody turns up to get into a special forces unit, team, division, whatever it is, with the expectation they're going to fail. They right. One would hope that they've got themselves, inverted commas, ready.
Yeah,
As in probably the fittest they've ever been, and they're absolutely right. It doesn't matter what happens to me, I'll blinking well see it through. And then there's a 90% attrition.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did you see? What did you start to make sense of from it? And just talk me through some of that.
It's actually a perfect place to start. And I think the reason is because you're absolutely right. People don't go to that type of training with the expectation to quit. Obviously, they go really feeling like they're going to make it through and wanting to make it through. And I think it's because of the misunderstanding that we all have in terms of what that type of training is really looking for. And I had to think about it when I was doing the work. I said to myself, in basic SEAL training, in BUDS, you spend hundreds of hours running around with heavy boats on your head and exercising with 300-pound telephone poles and running around with those things and then freezing in the surf zone. And I thought back to my times in the SEALs, and I've done hundreds of combat missions overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, and never on one of them did I ever carry a boat on my head or a 300-pound telephone pole, right? And so the whole SEAL training moniker is a little bit misleading. They're not training us at all. They're not training us in the skills to be Navy SEALs when they're doing that stuff. What they're doing is they're putting us into situations and environments that are teasing out these qualities, these innate qualities, these attributes, to see if we had and have what it takes to do the job. Not if we can do the job, like have the skills to do the job, if we have what it takes to do the job. And so I think people show up to this type of stuff and they think it's all about being physically fit, and they think it's all about being prepared in ways like, oh, I'm going to make sure I know how to scuba dive or have some shooting experience or things like that. But what they don't realize is it's not about that at all. It's not about the skills. It's about the qualities. It's about the attributes. Special operators, whether they be Navy SEALs, whether they be Army, whether they be British SBS and SAS, with whom I worked with quite a bit, it's all the same stuff. They are the units. The job of those units is not the sexy stuff we see on TV to be the perfect shot or skydive or scuba dive. The job of those units is to be what I call masters of uncertainty, the ability to drop into an environment that's deeply uncertain, challenging, and stressful, and make things happen and perform. And that takes these attributes, not skills.
So I imagine, actually, it doesn't almost matter what level you turn up at. The people that are running the course will see the level you're at and apply the stress relevant to the context that you're in. So it almost doesn't matter.
And this is why cold, I mean, they use cold. The thing most people remember about SEAL training is the cold, because cold evens the playing field for everybody. You know, whether you're the most physically fit person on the planet or you're someone who's not very physically fit at all, you're going to get cold no matter what, and it makes you miserable. And so it was quite often you'd see these super athletes show up and they'd be the first to quit. Whereas you'd see guys show up that didn't, you know, they grew up on a farm and they just didn't have any experience and they made it through. And you're right. The instructors there, I mean, there are rumors, and I think, you know, the rumors always fluctuate in terms of their intensity, but there are true stories of people showing up to SEAL training, not knowing how to swim. And the instructors are like, oh, we can teach you how to swim. I mean, if you're brave enough to come here to SEAL training without knowing how to swim, you have something inside you that we want, right?
Well, you're either an absolute idiot and you won't be seeing it through.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you might be crazy, but hopefully we'll see if you're actually in fact crazy. But no, it's usually that it's these attributes. So I think it'd probably be fair to me to kind of break down the difference for the audience. And so, kind of briefly, you know, skills.
Bring the attributes and the skills to life, right?
Yeah. So let's just break these two things down. Skills are not inherent to our nature, right? None of us are born with the ability to ride a bike or shoot a gun or drive a car. Okay. We learn to do those things. We train to do those things. We're taught to do those things. Skills also direct our behavior in kind of known situations, right? Here's how and when to drive a car. Here's how and when to shoot a gun. Here's how and when to ride a bike. As such, because they're visible and they're kind of didactic that way, they're very easy to see and therefore very easy to assess, measure, and test. You can see how well anybody does any one of those things. You could put scores around them. You could put stats around them. This is exactly why when we're building teams, we often get seduced by the skills, because skills are so easy to see. They're so easy to measure. You can put them on a resume, right? You could put them into numbers and you could put them into scores. But what skills don't tell us is how we're going to operate in uncertainty, challenge, and stress. Because when the environment becomes unknown, it's very difficult to apply a known skill. to an unknown environment. This is when we begin to lean on our attributes. Attributes, on the other hand, are innate. Okay, all of us are born with things like adaptability, resilience, situation awareness, open-mindedness. Now, certainly they develop over time and experience, but you can see levels of this stuff in small children. Anybody who's had kids will say, yeah, I can tell if my one-year-old is a patient child or an impatient child, right? We have some of this stuff as we're born. The other thing that attributes do is they don't direct our behavior, they inform our behavior. They tell us how we're going to show up to a situation, right? So my son's levels of resilience and perseverance, for example, informed the way he showed up when he was learning the skill of riding a bike and falling off a dozen times doing so. Okay, so they inform how we're going to show up. And then because they're hidden in the background, they're hard to assess, measure, and test. Okay, you can't sit across the table in an interview process, for example, and assess how adaptable someone is or how resilient someone is. Okay, they're hard to see. They are the most visible and visceral during times of challenge, uncertainty, and stress, when the environment becomes unknown.
So you can try and ask a couple of clever questions and put them under a bit of pressure just to see, but that's only contextual to the context that you're actually in right now, as opposed to...
That's right. That's right. And you have to understand, and so that work, and people ask, how can you replicate this in an interview? And I would say, well, in an interview, it's actually tough. This is why protracted interview processes are better, right? Where it's not just sitting across the table from someone. Maybe it's you're going to have them at a social event, then you're going to see them in the office, or you're going to do different things. You're going to put them into environments, into contexts. But yeah, the idea is to put a little bit of uncertainty and stress in there to inflict the ability for them or the inability for them to use skills. You know, let's see how they roll. Here's a good example. People ask me, just from a business standpoint. And so say, Guy, you and I wanted to hire someone who is good at sales, okay? And we tell this person on a Friday, we say, hey, show up Tuesday morning and you're going to sell us this pencil, okay? This pencil you're going to sell, right? They show up Tuesday morning, you and I sit down, they get in front of us and they give a kick-ass presentation on the pencil, right? And we're like, okay, wow, that was great. The problem is we haven't learned much. All we've learned about this person is they know how to prepare themselves and give a great sales pitch. So instead, what we do is we say on Friday, hey, you're going to show up on Tuesday, you're going to sell us this pencil. And then on Tuesday morning when they show up, we say, hey, the plan's changed. You're no longer selling us a pencil. You're going to sell us this coffee mug. Okay. And oh, by the way, there's no audio visual. You're not allowed to use slides or anything. Okay. Now, at that point, you and I have to do something. We have to make a very deliberate decision to divorce ourselves from skills assessment, because what we're about to see is probably going to look ugly, okay? But we're not looking at skills anymore. We're seeing how they react, okay? Are they adaptable? Are they humorous? Are they situational? Do they make the most of it? Do they move on the fly? Or do they kick the dirt? Do they complain? Do they make excuses, right? We're going to start to see attributes come to the fore rather than skills. This is an example of how to start looking for attributes.
I'm fascinated by that. I, many, many moons ago in a different life span, I was head of leadership and learning for an organization. And I was looking for somebody to head up a particular part. And everybody was great on their CV. You know, we all break bread and feed children and walk on water and, you know, save children from burning buildings. So I was like, I don't know how to choose, because everybody's telling me they're awesome.
Right.
They were telling me I need to be first. So I got them to the head office and I had some training rooms in play, and I walked them around and I got to a door and I opened it up and I just said, hey, can you take this over for half an hour and just do some delivery? Doesn't matter what.
Yeah.
And you know what? I had four or five candidates. A couple went, no. Nah. And a couple just went, yeah, if you like. Just wandered in and go, hi guys, how are you? Right. And they just, I went, okay.
Right.
You know, no, fair or not fair, who cares?
But well, and in that one, the other thing people have to recognize is they have to understand which attributes they're looking for. So in that scenario, for example, if we were to say, okay, you're looking for someone who can very comfortably present in front of people, right? Now you're looking for social intelligence, you're looking for curiosity, you're looking for adaptability, you're looking for some sort of a little bit of extroversion, right? There may have been some candidates that were perfect for other jobs in your organization, but not perfect for the one you were looking for. Therefore, they were like, nope, I'm not going to, you know, because it's funny, because you say that, and I think about myself. I came out, as I was coming out of the Navy, I have this thing where I think growth for me is to continue to explore my edges, my boundaries, those things that make me uncomfortable. And I know coming out of the Navy, I did not like speaking in front of people at all. I mean, not surprising, we don't do much of it as Navy SEALs, right? But I said to myself, I knew I wanted to at some point write, and I knew that I wanted to kind of conquer this field. So I deliberately took a job speaking in front of people, and it was really tough for the first year or so. I mean, I just didn't like, I mean, I was nervous every time and all that stuff. And slowly I got more comfortable. So the reason why I tell you that story is if you rewind the clock 4 years, you did that to me, I might have been one of those people who said, no, thank you, right? Today, though, I would have been someone's like, yeah, no problem, right? Because I've developed that. I've deliberately developed that. So understanding which attributes you're looking for is actually really important when you start putting people under pressure.
Yeah, I totally buy into that. And just that particular need was for people that, if the projector wasn't working, the room wasn't right, they just go, oh, it doesn't matter,
Right.
etc.
Yeah. Move on.
And you're
Yep.
right. And I think, yes, it's not that you may not be the right person, but you might not be the right person right now.
Yes.
That's
Yes. Yeah.
that's a different thing.
And this is actually, I talked to businesses about this when we go and consult, we say, listen, this is when we start looking at your teams in terms of the attributes required for your teams. And then once we know that and we start looking at what each team member is bringing to the table, right? This is not an exercise of who to get rid of. This is an exercise to see if people are positioned properly, right? Because there might be someone who's been underperforming, but the reason why is because they're not in a job that's actually accentuating those attributes that they have a lot of, right? And so just quickly, just so your audience knows, I don't purport that we have some of the attributes and we don't have other attributes. All of us have all of the attributes. And in the book, I talk about 25, but there are more than 25, obviously, but I talk about 25. All of us have all of them. The difference in each one of us are the levels to which we have each, right? So take adaptability, we've kind of been talking about. I would rate myself from 0 to 10, 10 being high, 0 being low, on probably at level 8 on adaptability. What does that mean? That means when the environment changes around me outside of my control, it's fairly easy for me to go with the flow. I'm like, okay, right, I roll with it, right? Someone else might be a level 3 on adaptability, which means that when the same thing happens to them, it's very difficult for them to go with the flow, right? Doesn't mean they're not adaptable, right? Just means they're lower on the level. So as humans, the exercise we kind of it behooves us to do is understand if we were to line up all of these attributes like dimmer switches on a wall, all of our levels for each attribute would be different. All of our lines would look differently. And I always kind of think about ourselves as human beings like cars, like. Some of us are Ferraris, and some of us are Jeeps, and some of us are SUVs, right? And there's no judgment there because the Ferrari can do things the Jeep can't do, and the Jeep can do things the Ferrari can't do. But it would behoove us to once in a while lift our hood, right, and see what actually engine we're running with, because we may in fact be a Jeep that's been trying to run on a Ferrari track, or a Ferrari that's been trying to run on a Jeep track. And so understanding our performance allows us to start making some cognizant and responsible decisions to say, okay, I'm actually a Jeep that's been trying to run on a Ferrari track. I actually want to go find a Jeep track to run on. Or you say, actually, I'm a Jeep running on a Ferrari track. I want to be that Jeep running on a Ferrari track. Now I know exactly what I need to work on so that I could be a better Jeep running on the Ferrari track. Because it's all our choice at the end of the day.
I'm really interested in now at 52 years old, I am dealing with more mature, sort of executive levels.
Yeah.
So when I was in my 20s, nobody wanted to be coached by a 20-year-old, right?
Right,
It may have been right, but who cared?
right.
That's not the point. So what I notice is that in the context of the times that we operate in, there's this concept of tame and wicked. Right, things that you've tamed, things that are wicked and complex, not rocket science, but it's quite obvious what it is. However, what I notice is that, back to your point, that some people have been very successful on a linear progression. And when maybe they get acquired by a different company with a different tempo, or they leave a very large company, and strange enough, very often at the tail end of a career, go into private equity and they come into smaller organizations, but it's a much bigger kind of cog in that wheel. And they leave these large organizations where they're used to pulling a lever and it's attached to something. And then they go to
Right.
smaller companies and they pull the lever and there's nothing there. And so they are in a situation where they've never had, for example, their adaptability tested.
Right.
Their resilience has never been that tested. I mean, it may have been a bit harder, but the network around them has been so profound that, you know, they've had 30 or 40 people that are desperate to impress them. So they've had an utterance, and it's, you know, it's like Jean-Luc Picard on the Starship Enterprise, you know, make it so.
That's right.
20
That's
people right. run and make it so. So I'm really interested in that. You're right. It's these things exist in people.
Yeah.
And I don't know what your thoughts on this is. This is what I'd like your thoughts on. I've often thought about bravery. And to my mind, there's two points of bravery. There's in the moment contextual bravery. You know, the house is on fire. Somebody runs in and saves somebody. You go, wow, okay, that's that. But then there's this everyday bravery, which I think for people in leadership roles, which is almost the motivation to learn, the motivation to go into a place of vulnerability and to be brave enough to face into the things that you've hidden from or just never had to face. And that is very often, I think, for a lot of people in the roles that I work with, that's for me is an indicative level of just, and I don't know if bravery is one of the attributes, but it's that willingness to face into that.
Yeah, it's an attribute. I call it courage, which is the same thing, right? And that's the number one attribute, actually. I don't rate them in terms of what's most important, but it's the first one I talk about, and it's the first one that comes underneath the grit category. So the grit. So I've broken these attributes into five categories. What are the attributes that make up grit? What are the attributes that make up mental acuity? Attributes that make up drive, and then attributes that make up leadership, and then team ability, which is your ability to operate on a team. The grit attributes are courage, perseverance, adaptability, and resilience. And courage is the first one. And the reason why is because it's vastly important in the human experience. When we talk about bravery, when we talk about courage, courage cannot exist in the absence of fear. Now, this is neurologically proven. And here's why. Fear does something to our system. So let's just talk about fear for a second. Fear is, in fact, the combination of two things. It's the combination of anxiety plus uncertainty, okay? If you have one but not the other, you don't necessarily have fear, all right? So you can be anxious but not uncertain, okay? That's like, I have to give a presentation for my boss next week, but I know my boss, I know the presentation. I'm a little anxious, I just want to do well, but there's nothing uncertain about what I'm doing, okay? There's no fear there, there's just anxiousness. You can be uncertain without being anxious, okay? Well, that's every kid on Christmas Eve, all right? So there's no fear there. Now, as soon as you combine the two, fear starts to show up and our amygdala starts to get kicked in, our threat detector in our brain. And when that happens, we get faced with two choices, which we all know of. It's either fight or flight. Most of us have heard of a third choice called freeze, but freeze is really neurologically just it's an oscillation between fight or flight. It's kind of a decision point where you're trying to decide what to do, okay? So there's really only two, there's fight or flight. What's interesting about the brain is that whichever one we choose is going to flip a specific individual circuit in the brain, okay? If we choose to fight, that means, and fight, we mean, it just means step into our fear. It doesn't mean necessarily put our dukes up and start punching, right? But it means step into our fear. If we choose to fight, there's a specific switch that gets flipped. That's the courage switch, okay? That means we're stepping into our fear. Now, our brain and our physiology has been designed to reward us when we do that. So when we step into our fear, when that flip switches, or the switch flips, right? We get a dopamine hit. We get a reward. Now, dopamine, we all know, one of the most powerful neurotransmitters that the human body creates. It basically says, this is good, keep doing it. It's the root of all addiction, all right? But again, we have to understand that we have been designed by nature to discover, to explore, to go find food, find shelter, to do new things, to try new things. And nature's done that by giving us a reward system to encourage us to step into our fear, okay? And so when we talk about bravery and courage, there's the acute stuff. There's the fire in the house, and we're gonna run and save. That's almost an instantaneous. Hey, I'm moving into my fear right now to do this. But then there's the daily stuff. Where it's like, hey, that's a little uncomfortable. That's uncertain, right? I don't know if I want to try that. The reason why there's a little bit of fear there is because there's uncertainty and anxiety. Now, it might not be as much as is produced when there's a fire in the next room, but there's still a little bit there. But we have to know that stepping into it, making the decision to step in, is going to reward us. It's going to feel good. And so we can, in fact, practice our courage by continually trying to do things that actually make us uncomfortable, make us a little bit fearful. Now, I'm not, you know, you don't have to go skydiving or bungee jumping right away, But you can practice fear. And then it comes with a caveat, though. The only caveat is that fear is designed by nature as something that allows us to appropriately risk assess. Okay, so sometimes the right answer is to flee. Okay, it's not a good idea to fight a bear, for example. Okay, but so we have to start recognizing and honoring fear for what it is. It's allowing us to risk assess. It's designed to keep us alive, right? But a lot of times in today's environment, where we're not having to worry about bears and saber-toothed tigers and things like that, a lot of times fear is misappropriated or blown out of proportion. And the best decision and the best thing that makes us feel good is I'm going to decide to step into it. I'm actually going to flip that courage switch. So yeah, it's a great point.
I've got to be honest, this is a bit of a topic of mine. I quite like it. So I've got to be careful I don't disappear down a rabbit hole with you. But I'm fascinated by that fight, flight, freeze. And I came across another one which added fawn to it. Which is this idea of, fight and flight and freeze. But fawn is almost this submissive, like a dog goes on its back and shows its belly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like it's fawning, basically. Yep. So that fight, I'm going to verbally, as you say, it's not put your jukes up in the middle of a conference or a meeting. Flight, I'm out of here, I'm leaving the room all the way through to I'm just, not having a conversation. That freeze thing is interesting. That's almost, I'm not able to engage with you. And in essence, I then probably get dominated because I can't. And then this fawn idea is I become consciously passive.
Yes, yes.
And that's an interesting...
Although I would argue that fawn is in fact still a decision and still a way that you're stepping into your fear, right? So I would say that, as soon as you engage the conscious mind in the decision process, you're basically engaging one of those two circuits. Mm-hmm. Whether you're fleeing, hey, I am retreating, I'm running away, or I'm stepping in. Now stepping in, I say this in the book in the decisiveness chapter. Stepping in doesn't necessarily mean I have to move forward. It means I'm making a decision. Sometimes the decision is to stop and wait, right? And I know that there were environments in combat where our decision in the moment was, hey, we're not moving right now. Let's just stop and wait. Let's hold position for a second. That's a decision. That's another way of actively moving. So
doing nothing is doing something. If you're
doing nothing, yeah. Right. If you're deciding. So I think the idea is if you're making a decision, that's in essence that's either the moving forward or moving back. So yeah, I do like that. I mean, there's my buddy who's a neuroscientist, Andrew Huberman. He and I have talked about this idea of.
I would give my left arm to get him on this podcast.
Yeah, he's awesome. He and I, in fact, if you read the first chapter, he and I were the ones who really talked about this courage circuit, And so when we talk about it together, what a wonderful dude, great friend, and he and I have talked about this idea of what's neurologically happening when you actually fawn. Well, and again, there's the passing out where your body just shuts down, which some animals do. They just go limp as if they're dead. Yep. But if you're deliberately saying, my decision here is I'm going to show my belly. I'm going to submit. In essence, that's my survival tactic, is to submit in this moment. That's a version of stepping in.
Yeah, and I've got that as a. I've got this phrase, which is what you tolerate becomes a tolerance. And if I'm fawning to just get through this and then I'll regroup and I'll come back, then that's okay, because that's common sense, that's political sensitivity, that's reading the room, recognizing you might not have the skill, better go and learn how to do it. But of course, if that fawning becomes something that you tolerate in yourself, it becomes a tolerance. Now you start to have it as a habit. And then sometimes, maybe even by accident, it's not who you think you are in your head, but it's what you've become.
Yes.
Because your habits aren't matching what your brain is telling you to do.
Yeah. You've become kind of almost, it's turned into a meekness,
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I like that. It to a meekness. I like that.
Yeah. And I talk about teams, and I talk about the way high performing teams actually operate. And one of the things I discuss in the book is this idea of dynamic subordination. The high-performing team understands that problems and challenges and issues can come from any angle at any moment. And when one does, the person who is the closest to the problem and the most capable immediately steps up and takes charge. And everybody else follows, right? And that's it. And then it happens again. And so it's a dynamic swap between leader and follower. I also call it alpha swapping, right?
Yeah, I'm not submissive, but in this context.
So you're fawning. So the fawning technique is actually a requirement for a team member to understand, hey, now is the time where I am going to let someone else take the lead. I'm going to support that person. Now, as a leader, it takes courage to do that. So I think leaders especially sometimes need to fawn deliberately, right? And this is tough. This takes courage to do so. Because as a leader, you say, hey, I know how this should be done. And I guarantee you I could do it the right way. But my job is not necessarily to make sure in this case, okay, there's certainly cases, to make sure this is done exactly the way it needs to be. My job is to develop these people in my span of care. The only way I can do that is to let this person roll with it. And I'm going to fawn. I'm going to basically show my belly and let this person step up and take lead and take the credit and do all that stuff. So I'm developing this person as a leader. That takes courage too.
So I'm really interested in this, and I'm sure, you know, as I said to you earlier, you know, a couple of bottles of wine and the right food, and I'd have you here all week. So vulnerability, mm-hmm. and not seeing that as making you vulnerable. Now, the caricature of somebody in some sort of special forces, I fear no man or any scenario, you know, I'm always right, I can always make decisions,
right?
But actually, as you grow up and you become a bit older, you realize, well, actually most of the adults I coach or train, at least 25-40% of the time, are somewhere between I don't know and I'm not sure and poor,
right?
Exactly. So of course they're there because of experience and insight and clarity, but there is a huge amount of uncertainty growing in the context that we're in. So that comfort with being vulnerable or vulnerability, just mm-hmm. how does that manifest for people that may, in your experience, of maybe they turn up believing, you know, you've got to be strong, you've got to be the one with the answers. How do you bring that to people's attention of it's okay to not know? You're not weak. In fact, you're strong. How does that pan out in your experience?
Well, interestingly enough, the environments of the tip of the spear environments that you kind of described in the first part here makes that happen, okay? Because when you are in a situation environment where your life is at stake or others' lives are at stake, it becomes much, much easier for you to immediately understand your limitations and your strengths. I talk about vulnerability a lot when it comes to teams. And vulnerability I describe as not just showing your weaknesses. It's also showing your strengths. It's basically wearing your strengths and your weaknesses on your sleeve so that your teammates can see exactly where they can lean on you and exactly where you'll be leaning on them, right? It's vulnerability is really transparency of your strengths and weaknesses. And so when you're in an environment that is high stakes and very dynamic, it becomes absolutely necessary to in the most immediate moment that you recognize that you don't have what it takes to solve this problem, you step back and let someone else do it, right? And so there are so many examples of this in terms of the way high-performing teams communicate with each other. It's almost like you're showing your vulnerability just through the way you're communicating. You're saying things like, okay, here's what I think could happen. Anybody have any other ideas, right? And in the highest stakes teams where you're kind of, you know each other well, the verbiage doesn't even have to happen, right? You just know who's stepping up, who's stepping back. You know, I was an officer in the Navy and in the SEAL team. So I was always in charge, right? It didn't mean my guys were always in support of me. No, on the contrary, most of the time I was in support of them. You know, certainly depending on what was going on the mission, sometimes they were in support of me. But oftentimes I was in support of the snipers, or I was in support of the assaulters, or I was in support of the breachers, right? It's constantly understanding where your position on the team is and executing that and then stepping back when you know, hey, this is not my, you know, the best person needs to step up. That takes a vulnerability. It takes a vulnerability for everybody to understand where their strengths and where their weaknesses lie. This is why ego and arrogance kill. I wouldn't say ego. I would say arrogance kills teams, because arrogance is I'm better than you. Arrogance is externally displayed and And arrogance will see people step up to do things when they're not capable of doing it. They will not cede their own vulnerability or their own weaknesses, and therefore it destroys teams.
What I really notice, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is that I was coaching somebody once and he said, I recognize that I rob people of their experiences, which was just a great phrase. And it took me a minute in conversation to understand what he meant. But he explained it to me. He said, you know, having done some of the work that we've been doing, he said, you know, back in the day when I started, you know, pre-mobile phones and all of the internet, if something went wrong, I had a week to put it right. But now, you know, if something goes wrong, everybody knows about it within the hour. And what are you doing about it? So I step in. I solve. I give the answers, because there seems to be the repercussions seem literally 3 minutes away, as opposed to, you know, don't worry about it, Bob. We'll put it right in the next couple of days.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about that, developing people to not even the vulnerability, I think, is to take control, to step away, to give people the ability to learn, knowing that there are going to be mistakes.
Yeah.
And how does that pan out in high stakes scenarios? You know, because the worst that happens in my world is that project got a bit waylaid. In your world, no. You know, this could be a life or death. So giving people the opportunity, even when it could go wrong, when we absolutely can't let it go wrong.
Yeah,
I'm really interested in that. Yeah.
It's certainly a balance of how you set up training environments so that you can allow people to make mistakes and learn from them. Let me give you, first of all, I'll give you an example. And people who are hesitant to let the people in their span of care fail, right? I always give the example of a child, right? Any parents, I would ask, you know, how long would you allow your child to learn how to walk? Right. And of course, people are like, what are you talking about? The kid's going to take as long as the kid needs to learn how to walk, because the kid's falling down and bumping heads. It's like, how long would you let that happen? Right. Well, I'm going to let it happen until the kid learns how to walk. Right. That's how we should think about most of our teams. Now, there is a caveat, right? You know, if someone is decidedly incompetent, just is not getting it, you know, then some decisions have to be made. I was for one of my SEAL platoons, we were doing this evolution where we were jumping out of airplane with our boats. So it was a water drop. So the boats would get out of the airplane first, and then they'd land. Some guys would go out with the boats. They'd get all the boats rigged up, and then they'd line up the boats in a line, and then the airplane would come around, and then the rest of us would jump out. And our job was to jump out so that we landed near the boats, got on the boats, and went, right? We were doing one of these, and it was a training evolution just here locally in the ocean. Beautiful day in the spring. And we were in the plane, and I had a guy, one of my guys was new to the jump master position. In other words, he was the guy in charge of the jump. He was the guy who's going to say, hey, now it's time to throw the boats out. Okay, now it's time for us to go out. And he's looking at the track. He's leading out the back of the airplane, looking at all this, right? So the boats go out fine. They line up. And now we're getting ready to figure out when we're jumping out to hit the boats. And I'm standing near him on the ramp as he's looking. And as I'm kind of looking, I'm saying, I see he's getting ready to kind of say, okay, it's time to jump. And I realize that we're not anywhere near where we should be. Okay. But at that point, I had to make a decision as a leader. I said, okay, wait a second. Okay. It's a daylight jump. Okay. We're jumping into the water, right? So it's not like we're going to hit any obstacles that are bad, right? Relatively, there are safety boats out there because it's a training environment. It's a nice day. The seas aren't rough. Let's just see how this plays out, all right? And so sure enough, he says go, and we get out of the aircraft, our parachutes open, and we are, I mean, at least a mile and a half from where we're supposed to be. We're nowhere near it, okay? And of course, the boats have to come pick us up and all that stuff. And, you know, we finished that evolution. We kind of went back, and we did a debrief like we always do. And the debriefs are always immediate, and they're always very real and candorous, right? We don't pull any punches in our debriefs, which is another sign of a high performing team. Okay, if you have the trust and the environments that where people can, you know, basically say how they screwed up immediately. And of course, this guy was feeling pretty down on himself because he put us out in the wrong thing. And so he went on. He went on for about 15 minutes on what he should have done better, what he could do better, all that stuff he learned. And at the end, I said, listen, if we had gone out there on this training evolution and everything had gone right, it probably would have been a waste of our time, you know, because we wouldn't have learned anything. Sure enough, several months later, maybe even a few months later, we actually had to go. We got deployed and had to go out and do this for real overseas, right? A real world boat drop, okay? And he was our jump master and he was in charge. And I tell you what, we were spot on. It could not have been a more beautiful spot from this guy, okay? And it's because he learned. It's because let's get into the neurology, because I know you're a neuroscience geek like I am, okay? And this is something Huberman and I talk about as well. When we create a neural network, okay, when we learn something, we create a neural synapse or a neural network connection, okay? And then once that happens, it gets coated with myelin, which is a kind of like a coating on these neural synapses. Well, learning those synapses, and the myelination of those happen. When those happen, there's a cocktail of neurochemistry that happens when that's created. Well, the three things that actually maximize the neurotransmitters that are required to learn are intensity, focus, and novelty. Okay, if we have all three of those things, we actually learn the fastest. It's almost like we get forged, our neural networks get forged. Okay, this is the difference between being told a stove is hot, okay, versus touching a hot stove. Okay, this is why when we learn the alphabet in the form of a song, okay, we remember it forever, right? Because it's intense. There's focus and there's novelty. Well, unfortunately, guess what mistakes do? Mistakes are basically the epitome of causing us to focus on what went wrong, the intensity of the emotion, and the novelty because it's a mistake, right? That's why we learn more when we make mistakes versus when things go right, because we have all three of those things that forge those neural networks. And so accelerated learning often happens in time of mistakes, which means as leaders, we need to, as much as we possibly can, let the people in our span of care make mistakes and learn from them.
I really like that. And it's one of those things where I vaguely remember what you just said there from somebody saying it a long time ago. But I'd forgotten it. So it's I've just relearned it, which is great. And there is something about, I think as well, I love this idea of candor. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great word. That willingness to have, I think that there's a book called Fierce Conversations, which is this kind of idea, you know, behind that. But they're not inelegant. They're not, I'm hitting you, you know, I'm not trying to hurt you in this conversation.
Yeah, yeah. They're done with care.
They're done with care. And I think in these, people talk about psychological safety. That's a big mm-hmm. phrase right now, right? And I think one of the big confusions is that doesn't mean it's got to be nice.
No, not at all.
It doesn't mean it's got to be easy, I should say, rather.
Right.
Actually, it is candor. It may be something that you really struggle with. It might put you into a place where you've really got to self-review.
Yeah.
But the safety is that I'm not trying to shame you. I'm not trying to doubt you, etc. So that's that candor. It really is, isn't it? There's a real sense of the individuals and the team's collective maturity.
Yes.
In being, and I imagine when you look at teams and individuals, that's something you can see pretty quickly.
You can. And also the intensity of the environment helps too, right? I mean, again, when you're at the tip of the spear, you don't have time not to learn, okay? You don't have time to wallow. You don't have time to kick the dirt and say, oh, woe is me. You don't have time to feel sorry for yourself. You have to get mistakes out in the open and learn from them as rapidly as possible. Because like you said, the next thing might be coming in the next hour or the next day, right? You don't have time to do that. So I think every team, as long as they're doing it with care and they're saying, hey, I'm doing this because I truly want to make the team better and make you better. You create this circle of safety, this environment of safety, the psychological safety. You create trust because you can't have trust without safety. You can't have safety without trust. What's cool about if you do this habitually is that those people who make those mistakes, you don't even have to tell them, okay? They're the first people to step up and say, hey, I screwed that up. And they tell you exactly why, because you've created an environment where everybody feels safe to do so, you know? So it's no longer you have to be, you almost have to give less candor to someone else because the team members understand, hey, as soon as I screw up, I'm going to make sure everybody knows how I screwed up and so we can learn from it, right? That's the environment you want to strive for.
And that's something I really notice in the difference that sometimes exists commercially, which is this next iteration. It may not be coming as quickly or right. the expectation of intent of change in the same way. And I think that's a beautiful gift to bring across, actually. It's that.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's that. So listen, I'm super alert to time. So I just want to keep talking. So I'm not going to, so just so you don't have to, you know, give me a kind of timeout signal and in some way. I'd love to know, just before I let you go, a podcast that you want people to listen to, a book, obviously your own. I'm going to be putting that in the description. I'm absolutely going to go and make sure that, you know, I tell people that they should take a look at it. But just, yeah, look, I think there's a great podcast you could listen to. I think there's a great book you could read if you're in that leadership space. I'm asking people this question now. Just, you know, the one that gets you going or makes you reflect, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I would say, yeah, definitely check out the book. If you go to the website, theattributes.com, we have a free assessment tool there that someone can take an assessment to see where they fall on the attributes, grit attributes, mental acuity attributes, and drive attributes. And then they can see what their scores are. And then if they read the book, they can understand that. So definitely check that out. You can see all the stuff for me is there in terms of Instagram. In terms of podcasts, listen, I'm going to plug my buddy Huberman, because Huberman and I, you know, when we met a good 4 or 5 years ago, and when we first started kind of, you know, jabbering and kind of talking about what we want to do, he had always wanted to, he said, you know, I really want to start getting some good science out to people. And he really has been able to do that. His podcast is absolutely fantastic. I think it's number one on the health charts right now. So he's doing a great job.
He was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's, yeah. And so he has a great way of describing science, you know, in a way that's understandable. So I would definitely recommend his podcast. And then, yeah, books. I'd say, other than my book, I'd say, listen, read books that get your creative brain spinning, you know. And it doesn't, you know, so in other words, some people, like in the military, this was a common thing. It's like, oh, people would say, hey, you need to read this military book or read this thing about this general. And I was like, I really didn't have any interest in reading military books while I was in the military. I wanted to read something that was completely outside of the military, because again, creativity comes when neural synapses are connected. And oftentimes that means you're connecting to elements that are seemingly not related, and you're finding connections between them. So this is the idea that, you know, I can read a book about basket weaving, and something in that book, you know, tweaks something that says, oh, I can actually apply this to military strategy, right? Then that's creativity, when you start applying diverse ideas and concepts and connecting them in ways that haven't been connected before. The only way we can do that is to open our minds up to different stuff, right? So I'd just say read different stuff, and you know, again, my buddy Stephen Kotler says all the secrets are in the books, so just keep reading books.
And is the best place to check out who you are, where do you want people to go to, is that Attributes?
Yes. Or theattributes.com is the best place. You can find everything there, about me, about the book, the assessment tool, speaking, you know, consulting, all that stuff. So
all one stop,
all my Instagram and LinkedIn, all that stuff.
Boom. So listen, I'm going to press stop in a moment, just stay on for 2 seconds just to make sure it's all done what it's supposed to have done. But just from me, and I think anybody listening, just thank you so much, Rich, for your time. Huge.
Oh, thank you, Guy.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. I will, once travel's back in session, we will we'll definitely have a bottle of wine in person and have a longer conversation. So.
Well, you say that now, but you're going to curse the day that you said, is this guy ever going home? thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Guy.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also, visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course, you can buy my book, Living Brave Leadership, on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.